Daniel Bryan has an obsession with bears.
I love bears, all sorts of bears. Black bears, polar bears, koala bears, brown bears, grizzly bears, which is also a kind of brown bear. Panda bears, teddy bears, everything. Oh, there it is! There it is! It's the bear hug! This is it, Josh! This is it! This is going to be the end of the match! Holy cow, he has him in the bear hug! I can no longer bear the suspense! I think he's going to tap! He got out!
Oh, he barely got out of that bear hug.
This is unbearable!
He's just got to grin and bear it.
Welcome to episode 277 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com and Stitcher Radio for Sunday, June 9th, 2013. I am the Sala Monster. We've got a lot of stuff to get to this week. Before we do, two very quick announcements. First of all, I am now doing some writing for the Yahoo Contributor Network, my first piece up right now. It is a look at why Brock Lesnar versus The Undertaker, if the match were to happen at all, makes sense for SummerSlam this year as opposed to WrestleMania. So you can find the link to that up on my Twitter or on Facebook. Share it with your friends. The more eyeballs, the better. And also, you'll want to check out my latest Layfield Report column at layfieldreport.com. I did a column on why the 1993 King of the Ring pay-per-view basically kicks all kinds of ass. King of the Ring 93 is one of my all-time favorite pay-per-view shows. Easily the best King of the Ring pay-per-view, in my opinion, the company ever did. And the significance of it is that this week, coming up on Thursday, June 13th, that day will mark the 20-year anniversary of the very first King of the Ring pay-per-view way back in 93. There were tournaments before that, but they did not air on TV. 93 was the first pay-per-view 20 years ago this upcoming week. Can't believe it's been that long. So I thought, why not talk about it? Why not commemorate the event? And even better, and you guys will like this, in the spirit of the 20-year anniversary of the King of the Ring back in 93, there will be a special bonus edition of the Sala Monster Sounds Off coming up this week, a special King of the Ring-themed edition of the Sound Off. Now, Thursday is the 20-year anniversary. The Sound Off will probably be going up later on Wednesday. That's June 12th, so that's when you can watch for it, subscribe in iTunes, however you want to get the show. Just be aware there will be a bonus show, Sound Off 278, King of the Ring edition, coming up this week. So those of you who like the theme shows and want more Sound Off content will be very happy. You'll have that coming up this week. We're not just going to talk about the 93 King of the Ring. We're going to talk about the tournaments that came before that you probably don't know too much about. We're going to talk about every King of the Ring pay-per-view, of which they had up until 2002, and the tournaments that have come since then. There was one in 06, one in 08. One in 2010. We'll talk about all those tournaments. We'll look at the different King of the Ring winners that did go on to have big careers. You know, who did the King of the Ring help make? And also, should the King of the Ring be brought back? So we're going to cover all that on episode 278. Again, watch for it this upcoming week, later on Wednesday. The show will go up, a special King of the Ring themed edition. Now, first thing I want to cover here before we get into any WWE or TNA stuff, the Chikara situation. Now, for those of you who don't know, Chikara, independent promotion, East Coast based. I talked about them a lot leading up to WrestleMania, post-WrestleMania, because we actually attended a Chikara Pro show at WrestleCon. It was my first Chikara show. Just looks like fun. The whole promotion is based on fun. I mean, hell, the promotion has a position called the Director of Fun. So obviously, it's a fun promotion. They've got a lot of wacky characters that do a lot of wacky, unrealistic, over-the-top stuff. It's like a comic book on steroids. You know, a comic book come to life. That's what Chikara is. And they had an iPay-per-view last weekend. And basically, the iPay-per-view ended under dubious circumstances. There was a main event going on. A couple of guys dressed in suits ran into the ring, interfered in the match. They started tearing down the set. They started kicking people out of the building. People were crying. Just a very weird situation. So basically, here's the deal. I do not claim to be the expert on everything Chikara. I've been reading up on this situation. I've asked a couple of people who are Chikara fans and other people, including one person who actually does some work for Chikara. As far as I can tell, the whole thing is just a very elaborate storyline. The end game here, I would assume, is that Chikara will eventually come back, but for all intents and purposes, it looks like Chikara is done. It is dead. They have these other little satellite promotions called Wrestling Is, and then there's usually a word that follows, so they have Wrestling Is Fun, Wrestling Is Respect, I think they have a few other ones. I don't know if all the Chikara talent will simply move over and start wrestling under those promotions' banners, or if they're just going to look elsewhere. Apparently some are looking for bookings. So I don't know if they're keeping some of their talent in the dark, which if they are, that seems kind of wrong to me. But it just seems like one giant, elaborate, secretive storyline that they're not filling people in on. This thing has been in the works for quite a long time, and there's time travel involved. I mean, it's just completely out there. I'm not even going to attempt to sit here and kind of figure out what the hell's going on, but I know there are some Chikara fans who listen to the show, and like I said, I went to a Chikara show for the first time only a few months ago. I enjoyed myself. At the end of the day, people just want to go to a wrestling event and have fun. So if they've got something planned, fine. But I wish that they wouldn't be so, so secretive about it. Not that I have any problem with them having a really creative storyline in mind and wanting to stay in character and not blow the surprise, whatever that surprise may be. But you have a lot of very confused people right now who, you know, may give up on Chikara or assume that the promotion is done and never coming back. And I would hate to think they would lose some of those fans. So whatever's going to happen, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But just a very weird situation. I don't really have a straight answer for you. Daniel Bryan and John Cena. Want to talk about this really quick. I did talk about that last week, about the idea that these two should be in the main event of SummerSlam, fighting over the WWE Championship. Bryan is at that level now. He's got a lot of momentum. That momentum should take him right to the main event of the second biggest pay-per-view of the year. And this week, a lot of rumors swirling that John Cena versus Daniel Bryan for the WWE Championship will in fact be taking place. However, not at SummerSlam, although maybe it will. Maybe it'll be a rematch. But the first match will be at Money in the Bank in Philadelphia next month. Now, again, none of this is confirmed right now. It's just a rumor until we see it play out on television. But apparently WWE is not deaf, dumb, and blind. They see the reactions Bryan is getting. They know how great his work is, how great he makes others when he's in the ring with them. And they have big plans for him, including, quote, pay-per-view main events. And one of those main events is with John Cena, possibly at Money in the Bank. Look, I have no problem with them doing John Cena and Daniel Bryan at Money in the Bank, especially given the fact that that show is in Philadelphia, which is one of those places where, I mean, you never know for sure what kind of crowd you're going to get. But when it comes to cities like New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Toronto, there are certain cities that when you go, you know you're probably going to get a lively crowd, probably a smart crowd with a lot of smart-ass people in there cheering for whoever they want to cheer for. It's the kind of environment, I think, that could be very similar to what we had with CM Punk and John Cena for Money in the Bank 2 years ago in Chicago. Now, that was Punk's hometown. I mean, they're not having Money in the Bank in Aberdeen, Washington, which is where Daniel Bryan is from. But it has the makings, in my opinion, for what could be a match of the year candidate. I mean, both guys, when they're on and they're in there in a pay-per-view main event or they're in there in a big match, both guys deliver. I mean, Daniel Bryan delivers every week. John Cena delivers typically in big match situations. John Cena's had a lot of great matches during his time in WWE. I don't think he quite gets the credit that he deserves for that. He and Punk have had just some tremendous matches together. I really think that he and Bryan, who never have had a major match before, they may have had one or two matches on Raw, but I barely remember them. They probably didn't have much time. I think that these two guys in the ring together could have that same type of chemistry that Cena had with Punk. And if they have that same type of chemistry, then that's going to make that pay-per-view worth the price of admission alone. I still feel like that's a big enough match that should headline for the first time at SummerSlam. But if they do the match at Money in the Bank and it leads to a rematch at SummerSlam, like what they did with Cena and Punk 2 years ago, I'd have no problem with that. In fact, I'd have no problem with them doing Cena versus Bryan for three or four pay-per-views in a row. I'm sure by the time they get to the fourth one, I'd probably be tired of it, but you'd get some pretty kick-ass matches out of it. And I don't know if they have plans of actually putting the title on Bryan. My guess would be no, but I'm not looking that far ahead. I would just like to see him in the ring with Cena on the same level, because I feel like he's earned it. He's earned it. He's worked his ass off. He's gotten to that point. He has the people behind him. You know, the company could like him a lot. He could have great, you know, four-star matches every week. And if the people sit on their hands, you know what? They're not going to do anything with the guy, and it's hard to argue. But the people are not sitting on their hands. The people are on their feet. They're screaming their heads off every single week. The time is now for them to pull that trigger, and it looks like they've got the same idea in mind, and I think that's great. Monday Night Raw this past week was from the XL Center in Hartford, Connecticut, not too far away from WWE headquarters in Stamford. Apparently, Raw and SmackDown this week both were rewritten hours before they went on the air, which is why we got Stephanie McMahon and Vince McMahon's big return on Raw Monday night. I guess that was WWE's secret weapon to combat the NBA playoffs, and unfortunately for them, it did not work. Raw got nailed, as most programming probably would have been, by basketball on Monday night, but I guess they felt like they had to really bring out their big guns and try to minimize the damage, and like I said, it didn't really work. They were advertising Triple H and Curtis Axel for Raw Monday in the hours before the show, so just keep that in mind. Stephanie comes out at the beginning, which was certainly a different way to open the show. She says that even though Triple H has been cleared to compete, she, in fact, would not be allowing it, and she was canceling the Triple H-Curtis Axel match. She said it's not about the fans, it's about her husband's well-being. She's told the people to stop being so selfish. So basically, Stephanie turned heel on the crowd. This whole thing, to me, felt really, really forced, almost like, you know, it just kind of came out of nowhere. I know they had some idea in mind for this whole, you know, Triple H storyline, and, you know, maybe they bumped things up because of, you know, again, wanting to load up the show to go against basketball. I don't know. I would think that if they were bumping things up, it would only be by a few weeks. I certainly would hope that, you know, if this was part of the story that was going to unfold a month or two from now, they didn't just say, shit, let's do it here. This whole thing just felt really forced. Like, here comes Stephanie, who we haven't seen on TV in months and months, and she announces that the match isn't going to happen. And, you know, the people booed because the people were hoping to see the match, and then they started a Triple H chant. But so what? You know, they like Triple H. And then all of a sudden, Stephanie's like, you know, how dare you be so selfish? I just, like I said, felt kind of forced to me. Vince McMahon comes out. He also turned heel on the crowd. He asked the fans not to boo his daughter, which only made them boo louder. He talked about the fans chanting one more time on SmackDown when Ryback was powerbombing Kofi Kingston through the tables. So they made reference to that and incorporated it into this storyline here. He said, WWE is not a blood sport, it's family entertainment. Take that, Dana White. Shield's music hit to save us from the McMahon show. They went to commercial break at that point, which actually was a great little cliffhanger to keep people guessing what was going to happen next. And what happened next was absolutely nothing. They came back. They told us that on the WWE app, if you were watching, the McMahons were able to just leave the ring without incident. That's awfully nice of the Shield to let them go. So yeah, that was a very lame cliffhanger conclusion there. That led to another six-man tag pitting the Shield against Team Hell No, and this time their partner was Randy Orton. Orton was super over in Hartford. They also went crazy, as always, when Daniel Bryan got the hot tag and cleaned house. There's really nothing else right now in wrestling quite like a Daniel Bryan hot tag. Again, he's really over right now, and who's to say, you know, 2 months from now if the crowd will be as loud for him as they are now? I think they will be. I think they can keep it up, unless he turns heel. Just absolutely flat-out turns heel and gets the crowd to turn against him, which I think would be dumb. But for the time being, I'm enjoying the hell out of it. It's a lot of fun to watch, and I'm just going to enjoy it as long as it lasts. Bryan gave Rollins an awesome Frankensteiner off the top rope. Rollins landed right on top of Dean Ambrose, who was laid out on the mat. And I noticed that Bryan has also been incorporating this spot into his matches, this move where he wraps his opponent's legs up kind of in a pretzel and just stands over them, so they have no way to wiggle out free. They're just kind of stuck. And he just starts raining blows down upon them with such ferocity. It's awesome. Awesome to watch. He just grounds and pounds them, or as Michael Cole would say, pounds and grounds them, into oblivion. And it actually comes off looking brutal as all hell. You know, that's one of the things I appreciate so much about a guy like Daniel Bryan as compared to, let's say, a John Cena. And I'm not trying to knock Cena here, but when you compare the two, and it's perfectly fine to compare the two since apparently they're going to be working together, Bryan's a smaller guy than John Cena. John Cena's not super-duper tall, but he's thick, he's muscular, he probably is a little bit taller than Daniel Bryan is. Bryan's smaller, but he's a far more believable ass-kicker in the ring than John Cena is. You know, his offense is just so much more believable. And I really noticed it in the Daniel Bryan Ryback match later on in the show on Monday when Bryan locked Ryback in the no lock. That move actually looks like it hurts. You know, pay attention to Ryback's arm. They had a great shot of Ryback in the no lock, and his arm, just all the torque that Brian was putting on it when he was, you know, just twisting it and pulling it back. And go ahead and compare that to John Cena putting somebody in the STF. Cena looks like he's in more pain than his opponent with all those silly faces that he makes. So it doesn't look painful at all. So that's really a major contrast, I think, between the two of them and their styles. Cena, you know, I guess as Jim Ross would say, Cena's not really a finesse guy. He goes in there, he's more of a brawler. He has his five or six moves or whatever it is that he does. And when he does the STF, which is one of his main finishing holds, it just doesn't look really devastating at all. Everything Daniel Bryan does when he gets hot and he gets, you know, in that crazed, intense way, everything he does looks like it hurts. When he drop kicks you in the corner, it looks like he's drop kicking your teeth right down your throat. You know, when he does that suicide dive, that tope through the ropes and hits you, I mean, he looks like a missile being launched right at your face. And you better be ready or you're going to get hurt. And the no lock as well. So that's one of those things, I think, that's also helping him. I think people look at him and go, shit, you know, this guy may be small, but he's kicking ass in there. And he looks believable when he does it. He doesn't look fake or phony or stiff or anything like that. So just an observation. Anyway, Orton got shoved into Bryan at the finish, which allowed Dean Ambrose to nail Bryan with his headlock DDT. So Shield wins another one. Great match. By the way, I see on commentary now, they're walking back what they had said previously about the Shield's undefeated streak being over. Michael Cole was talking about how, well, you know, they haven't been pinned or made to submit. And that's a big 180 from what they were saying right after the Shield lost that six-man tag to John Cena a few weeks ago. Which begs the question, why did they lose in the first place? Don't beat them, and you won't have to issue a verbal correction on television. Backstage, Bryan was none too pleased with Randy Orton. Orton basically said, shit happens. He didn't use that word, of course. He tried to get Bryan to settle down. It didn't work. Bryan said that Randy Orton must think he's also the weak link. And he just will not drop the weak link stuff. He said he's going to have a second match tonight. And the cheer that you heard in the background when he said this was me in my living room. And Bryan said that he will have to simply beat the respect into somebody. I thought with Triple H out of the picture that Bryan would have been the perfect opponent for Curtis Axel in the main event, which would have been a hell of an idea, I think, because it would have given Axel his best match to date and a win over the hottest act in the company right now. You know, he's had some wins over John Cena and Triple H, but they're bullshit wins. Everybody knows they're bullshit wins. If he goes in there for 10 or 12 minutes or 15 minutes and has an awesome match and looks like $1 million, it's going to help the guy. But I guess they had other ideas in mind. Triple H showed up late to the building, which is always nice to see the COO not only showing up dressed in a t-shirt, but late to his own show. He was looking for his father-in-law. He argued a bit with Stephanie and Vince once he found them. Triple H said, I am wrestling tonight. Vince said, no, you're not. Triple H said, yes, I am. Vince said, no, you're not. I thought they were going to go into the whole wabbit season, duck season routine here, but they didn't. And Vince told him, don't do something you're going to regret. And he walked off, and that was that. The Usos were back on TV, and they've got face paint. That's how you know they're getting a push. That, and they had pyro for their entrance. Zack Ryder's growing his hair out. That means he's also about to get a push. They actually do supposedly have plans for Zack. He won, Noah was at the Fort Lauderdale house show on Friday night, and he reported that Zack Ryder actually won not one, but two matches at that house show on Friday. In his first match, he beat Antonio Cesaro. And then he beat Brad Maddox in the second match. Yes, Zack Ryder beat Antonio Cesaro. Anyway, the Usos beat the primetime players here in this match. I like the Usos. It's nice to see them getting a push, even if it is just because they need to build up some people to feed to the Shield because they have no other tag teams that are over right now. I love Michael Cole's explanation for why, after all these years, the Usos are suddenly wearing face paint. He said, it gives them an edge. Hey, you know, Jeff Hardy started wearing face paint and got himself over as a main eventer. Maybe there's something to that. I like the face paint. I actually think we need more wrestlers wearing face paint in wrestling. Big E Langston and Alberto Del Rio had about their 15th match in about 3 weeks, give or take a few. Dolph Ziggler was not on this show, but Dolph, for those who do not know, did pass impact testing backstage at the arena. He is finally cleared. So thank God Ziggler will be back on Raw this Monday. Finish came with Langston caught in Del Rio's arm breaker, trying to use his strength to power out of it. That didn't work. Then he tried to roll out of it. He's trying, and Del Rio kind of hooks Langston's leg forward for the pin. Langston was trapped, could not kick out. I actually like this finish a lot, aside from all the... we got to see a little bit too much of Big E Langston with this pinfall. His singlet is very short, and when he's all rolled up like that with his rear end sticking up in the air, it's not a pretty sight. But aside from that, I like the finish. I actually liked it because it reminded me of the Bret Hart British Bulldog match from SummerSlam 1992 in Wembley Stadium. If you remember that finish, Bret Hart came off the ropes. He went for a sunset flip, but Bulldog kind of dropped to his knees and fell forward and pinned Bret's legs to the mat. It's one of those moves where the other person just isn't kicking out. You know, there's just no way. So this finish was different. I liked it. It wasn't just him beating it with his move or another DQ or countout, which is a big problem right now in WWE. It really is. I mean, it feels like every other match on these shows just ends in a DQ or a countout or a walkout. It's completely ridiculous. So this was different. I liked it. And I assure you, this is the only time you will ever hear me comparing a Big E Langston Alberto Del Rio match to Bret Hart and the British Bulldog at Wembley Stadium. Sheamus beat Cody Rhodes with the brogue kick. Nothing much to it. Damian Sandow was on commentary. He's actually the one feuding with Sheamus right now. And after the match was over, Sheamus goes outside over to the announce desk to harass Damian Sandow. He was harassing the poor guy. He wanted a handshake. Sandow doesn't trust him. And so he swats Sheamus' hand away, refused to shake it. So what does Sheamus do? He punches Damian Sandow in the face and knocks him to the ground. A total bully this man is. Sandow didn't interfere in the match. He was calling the action, minding his own business. And Sheamus just pops him right in the face. This man has to be stopped. This is completely ridiculous. Backstage, Triple H left the building, but not before telling his wife that he's only leaving because he doesn't want to have to tell their kids how he beat the crap out of their grandpa. He better hide those Armageddon 99 DVDs if that's the case. Triple H said no matter what, he will be wrestling Curtis Axel next week. I doubt that very seriously. I figure they're going to save it for payback. Also backstage, Daniel Bryan ran into the Ryback. That's what he calls him in interviews, the Ryback, whenever Daniel Bryan does publicity. He and Ryback are actually travel buddies, or at least they used to be. You know, in the era of kayfabe, or kayfab, as Joe Park might say, if someone like Bill Watts caught you together in public while you were feuding at the same time, or if, let's say, one guy was a babyface and one was a heel, you would be fired on the spot. But kayfabe is dead, so it's all good. Ryback called him the weak link. They made a match for later in the show. One of our listeners, also named Brian, ironically, from upstate New York, he very astutely pointed out that Ryback was openly talking about Kofi Kingston having surgery on Thursday for something that, as the announcer said, happened Friday on SmackDown. I think most people know the deal with SmackDown being a taped show. They pretty much acknowledge it on their website. You know, Paul Heyman's Triple H didn't want to work Tuesday's line from One Night Stand a few years ago, but aside from that, I don't think they've ever really admitted on their TV that SmackDown is a taped show. So somebody kind of slipped up on that one. Elsewhere, Curtis Axel and Paul Heyman met with Vince McMahon, who made Axel versus John Cena in the main event. And it will be a no disqualification match, he said. Great Khali beat Fandango by countout after Fandango and Summer Rae just walked out. WWE's beloved heel walkout finish that they are so fond of giving us at least once a week. And as Fandango was leaving, Miz came out to block his path, and Wade Barrett snuck up behind Miz and knocked him out with the bullhammer elbow. So we go to commercial, back from commercial, and we see it's Wade Barrett against the Miz. And they're wrestling. Fandango comes back out midway through the match. He's dancing on stage with Summer Rae. And this distracted Wade Barrett, who apparently is like a 3-year-old child and is easily distracted, or like John Cena with pretty colors. And so Barrett turns back around, and Miz is waiting for him, gets him in the figure four, Wade taps out. This all leads to a triple threat match at Payback, where I presume Fandango gets the Intercontinental Championship. We had a contract signing, the first of two contract signings on WWE television this week, if you count NXT, which we'll get to later. This one had Chris Jericho and Paul Heyman, who are in fact not having a match at the pay-per-view. Heyman was there as CM Punk's surrogate. Punk was not even watching Raw. I think he was at a hockey game that night. The week before, I think he was at a baseball game. You know, I get the impression that Punk doesn't even give a shit about wrestling and would be perfectly content just to travel around to Cubs and Blackhawks games for the rest of his life. And, hey, he deserves it if that's what he wants to do. Heyman and Jericho were great in this segment, but they didn't really have anything to say. It just felt like they're sitting there, they're stalling for time. I'm not even really sure what the point of this whole segment was. In the end, Jericho signed the contract, and he stuffed it down Paul Heyman's pants. Because that's how we do things in wrestling. Caitlin and the Funkadactyls beat AJ and the Bella Twins. Divas stopwatch clocked this one at 4 minutes 30 seconds, which is like an eternity for a Divas match. I was going to say something nice about this match, and then I watched the Gail Kim Taryn Terrell match from the TNA Slammiversary pay-per-view, which kicked ass, by the way, and I changed my mind. This match really was no good. They're still claiming that AJ is in line for the next Divas title shot, but they will not tell us when. I don't know why they wouldn't just do it at Payback. Maybe they will. You know, we have one more week before the pay-per-view, and even if they don't announce Caitlyn and AJ on Raw this week, they could very easily add it at the last minute the day of the show, so it could happen there, but they didn't say that it would. They just said that she would get her title shot at some point. Backstage, Brian was being a real dick to Kane. I gotta say, they must have really hooked me into the storyline here, because I find myself feeling real bad for Kane whenever Daniel Bryan goes off on him like this. Like, you know, Kane comes off as somebody who actually likes Bryan now and cares about the dude, who doesn't think he's the weak link and all that jazz, and Bryan just yells at him and shouts him down and insults him. I feel bad for Kane. Bryan said he wants to prove he's not the weak link. He will do so without Kane's help, and Kane says, okay, I'm out of here, and he left the building. We got another Wyatt family promo, and when the video was over, it sounded like the fans were cheering in the building, which is interesting. Bryan versus Ryback. Best singles match on TV that Ryback has had, maybe ever. Crowd was kind of quiet for the first half of the match, and then slowly but surely, Bryan got them into it. Ryback was perfectly fine. He played his role well, and by the end, Bryan had the people going crazy, especially when he made his comeback. He capped it off with a diving headbutt off the top, got a great near fall where people so badly wanted to see him win, and he had them convinced that he actually might win. And, you know, this would be a great time for Bryan to revive his old I have till five gimmick with the referee that he used to do all the time in Ring of Honor. He would use, like, an illegal move or you know, choke or whatever, and the referee would tell him to break it, and he would count till four, and then Bryan would shout that he actually has till five, and the people would go crazy. I really think it would get over big time if they wanted to do it. Maybe he can do it, he just chooses not to, I don't know, but I'd like to see him bring that back. Bryan beat Ryback by DQ after Ryback powerbombed him through a table. Ryback had some further destruction planned for Bryan. He brought another table out, propped it up against the barricade, and John Cena ran out to make the save. I think Bryan cut his arm on the table, some debris, because when the show was over, I saw a shot of him walking back to the locker room, and his arm was all cut up and bleeding pretty good, so hopefully he's okay. Bryan and Ryback actually picked up over 460,000 viewers on Raw Monday night, which is actually tremendous growth for that point in the show. 10:30 is normally the spot where matches go to die, both not just in the ratings, even in the building. I mean, think about it. People have been sitting there for so long. By that point, well over 3 hours, and it's understandable when they put a match in that slot. And Randy Orton has actually had a lot of matches in that spot at 10:30. Where the crowd just doesn't seem to give a shit at all, and it's not his fault, it's not the wrestler's fault, it's just that people are so burned out, but you would never know by watching this match here on the show. So hats off to Ryback, hats off to Daniel Bryan, they got the people into it. Like I said, a net gain of 460,000 viewers for them in that segment. The John Cena Curtis Axel main event only gained 430,000, so they gained viewers too, but they actually gained fewer viewers for that match in the main event than Bryan and Ryback did in the 10:30 spot. You know, it's one thing for people to scream yes at the shows and to throw their arms up in the air and for Bryan to go out there and have great matches every week. We all know that at the end of the day, it boils down to ratings with these people. So it's nice to see that he actually has some momentum in that department too, that's the quickest way to get WWE to notice you. That and if you sell a shitload of merchandise. And speaking of which, Brian does need a new t-shirt. That no, stop it shirt that he has is just creepy as all hell. When your t-shirt is something a rape victim would scream, I think it's time to try something different. John Cena and Curtis Axel, the rematch we got in the main event. Michael Cole referred to Curtis Axel multiple times on this show as Curtis Angle. That would be incorrect. Curtis Angle is going into the TNA Hall of Fame in October. It was a no DQ match, so both guys used the chair on each other. Yeah, they had some good action. Cena had Axel outside the ring when the Ryback reappeared. He threw John Cena into that table that Ryback had propped up against the barricade from the previous match that the referee, for whatever reason, didn't get rid of. You'd also have to ask the referee why he was counting both men during this no DQ match, and in fact, that's how Axel won. Curtis Axel won with his new finishing move, the countout, in a no DQ match. Now, I understand that DQs and countouts are two separate things, I get that, but for as long as I can remember, I cannot recall seeing a no disqualification match where you could be counted out. You know, maybe I'm wrong, and there's been one here or, you know, one there, but normally that just, it doesn't happen. The whole premise of a no DQ match usually is that there must be a winner. Someone will be pinned or made to submit. I can't remember, I mean, certainly no major match I can't remember with a no DQ stip ending in a countout. And if it did, I would say the same thing I said here about this match. This finish sucked. You don't need to end a no DQ match with a countout, especially when we already have one other countout on the same show. That's not how you end your main event. You know, that being said, it doesn't overshadow the fact that we got two awesome Daniel Bryan matches on the same show, and so for that reason, Raw gets a thumbs up from me this week, even with the shitty, nonsensical finish. While we're on the subject of John Cena, two quick Cena-related notes here. If you did not read the transcript or listen to the Randy Orton interview on the Busted Open radio show, you owe it to yourself to go check it out. It was actually a really good interview, and there was one quote from Orton I wanted to single out here on the show this week. They were talking about how, gimmicks and catchphrases come about, whether it's planned, does it just kind of happen, is it organic? This is a quote from Randy Orton where he mentions John Cena. He says, "A lot of the time, things like that come out of nowhere. You just stumble onto something. Hasn't really happened with me, but you'll see it happen. I'm not the stick guy. I can't go out there like John Cena and cut a babyface promo that makes you want to kill yourself 5 minutes in. As good as he can. You know what I mean? No offense, John. Obviously, he's very successful, so I don't know what I'm talking about." I love these Randy Orton interviews when he's just out there speaking his mind, completely unfiltered, you know, not being censored or anything like that. It's just great because you get to hear what, not just Randy Orton, but I'm sure what a lot of people who work backstage for WWE are thinking. It's like the Orton interview when he was promoting his movie last week I talked about. He had that comment about Curtis Axel and being stuck with the Michael McGillicuddy name and how that was career suicide, and yet he was able to survive it. I mean, a lot of us felt that name was career suicide, as many of the names were that they were doling out for years in developmental, and who knows how many careers got sidetracked because of it. It's nice to know that there are people who actually work in the company who are on television who feel the same way. WWE also announced they have signed a deal with Kmart to market John Cena Never Give Up merchandise for children starting this fall. And this is a quote from John Cena in the press release. He said, "I am excited to announce WWE's relationship with Kmart and bring the Never Give Up by John Cena collection." That's the name of this stuff, actually. What is this? Like Estee Lauder or something like that? Anyway, "bring the Never Give Up by John Cena collection to all of our young fans. For the first time ever, young shoppers will be able to go to Kmart and find a new line of apparel that expresses my lifestyle and my Never Give Up attitude." So, if you have a son or a daughter that's young child, 5 years old, maybe 8 years old, wants to go buy some John Cena merchandise, now they can go to Kmart. I guess that's kind of cool. It's actually the ones that I think are probably age 13 and up. They're the ones I'm really worried about. They're the ones with the John Cena hat, the John Cena armbands, and the John Cena wristbands, and the John Cena t-shirts, and the John Cena foam fingers, or whatever the hell else they sell, the garden gnomes and all that stuff. Those are the folks I'm worried about. It's like Bieber fans. You know, whenever somebody says something bad about Justin Bieber, you ever go on Twitter and read some of the comments. Frightening. Want to dedicate a few minutes here to NXT. I'm very happy I've been able to watch NXT now. This is my third straight week. NXT is a really good show. I'm sure a lot of you who watch it internationally or here in the States on Hulu Plus already know this. I'm only first discovering how good the show really is. It's just a pleasant, easy-to-watch, fun 45 minutes without commercials edition of wrestling. You know, it's not too long. It's not 3 hours. There's not a lot of crazy bullshit and comedy and all that stuff. It's just very enjoyable and very easy to follow, which I think is what every wrestling show should be like. They opened the show this week with a contract signing. Jim Ross came out. So we can get Jim Ross on NXT. We just can't get him on Raw. Okay, I got that. Jim Ross comes out. He calls out Bo Dallas, number one contender. He was the one who won the Battle Royal last week to earn himself a title match. And then comes Big E Langston, the reigning NXT champion. Both men take their seat. Bo Dallas goes to sign the contract, stops himself, and grabs the microphone. Now, before I even heard Bo Dallas do his promo here on this show, when he reached for the mic, I kind of cringed. Because the story on Bo Dallas is, technically in the ring, he's actually really good. He's a good wrestler. And I think he's a good babyface, although it seems like he's obviously going heel. Can get the fans behind him like he's good. On the microphone, not so much. So I was very curious to see how this was going to turn out. Even when they had him on television feuding with Wade Barrett, if you recall that one episode of Raw, they had an inset promo like they used to do way back in the early 90s on Superstars and Wrestling Challenge. A little box came up, and Bo Dallas did a promo that was awful. It was bad. So did he improve? Did he not improve? He grabbed the mic. He needs a lot of work. He started the promo, and what happened is there were people in the crowd who started heckling him, and they started a chant of, I think it was No More Bo. So they were just chanting No More Bo, No More Bo, over and over again. So Langston is sitting down. Langston is smiling, probably because he figures it's funny. And Bo Dallas is staring at Langston. He's standing up now, and he also is doing everything in his power not to laugh. He's smiling. He looks like he wants to laugh, but he doesn't actually laugh. He starts talking, and he sounds like... I have seen people on independent shows cut really good promos. Like, I'm talking small independent shows with like 100 people. And Bo Dallas, for the first like 15 seconds or so of this promo, sounded worse than anybody I had ever heard at one of these indie shows. He sounded like it was amateur hour. And he got a little bit better as it went on because he kind of regained his composure. He was pointing at the NXT title belt, talking about what it meant to him, and, you know, 3 seconds is all it takes to change my life and all that. And he got serious, so he improved as it went on. But boy, you watch the first 10, 15 seconds of this promo, it was bad. It was really, really bad. But that's why these guys are down there. You know, they're learning the tricks of the trade. They're learning the ropes. They're getting better each week. Big E Langston, he got a chance to get some mic time. Big E Langston is awesome. He's very confident. He speaks with a loud voice. It's not hard to understand him. He didn't lose his composure. He got serious. You know, he was kind of laughing and joking and calling. He called Bo Dallas a geek and all this stuff. But then he got serious, and he said, I'm not going to need 3 seconds to beat you. I'm just going to need five. Because in NXT, he does the five-count gimmick like King Kong Bundy used to do, and the people are into it. He said five. The people cheered. They both signed the contract. Bo put the contract in his chest, walked off, and that was that. So, you know, they set the stage for the championship match, which is coming up next week on NXT. Bo Dallas, though, he's got to work on those promos because he is not ready for prime time. Big E Langston, on the other hand, is very much ready for prime time. And I think when the time comes that he goes babyface on television, whether he turns on Ziggler or maybe he doesn't turn on Ziggler, he just kind of breaks away from him and AJ and does his own thing and goes babyface, he's going to be a big star. I really think that Big E is going to be a big star. Paige beat Tamina Snuka in an NXT Women's Title Tournament match. Tamina did this thrust kick later in the match. She caught Paige right on the jaw. It looked awesome. It sounded even better. It made that smack sound effect like she just kicked her head off her shoulders. She went up for the Superfly Splash. Paige got her knees up, rolled up Tamina to advance in the tournament. Paige is an interesting one. She is from Norwich, England. So she's from overseas. She looks different than probably any other WWE diva on the roster right now. And what I mean by that is she looks real. You know, she looks like, I hate to use that girl next door expression because it's so cliche, but it probably is appropriate to use it here. You know, she's not all made up with the big boob job and the fake tanner and all that stuff. And I think for that reason, she's going to have a lot of appeal when she makes it up to the main roster. She just got done feuding with Summer Rae. They had like a months-long feud. So she's been busy with Summer Rae, and who knows, you know, maybe soon enough we'll see her and Summer Rae on Raw or SmackDown one week reuniting their feud on TV. Mason Ryan beat Colin Cassidy in basically a squash. You know, I say it all the time. Ryan is gargantuan. I mean, he's not even as big as he used to be on TV before they sent him back down. He is still massive. He doesn't look quite as clumsy in the ring as he used to, but, I mean, I would hesitate to say that he's improved all that much. I just haven't seen enough of him to really make that claim. Even this match, it was maybe, you know, 2 minutes long, 2.5 minutes. He did fine, you know, he's got the big power moves and all that, but I can't really say that he's so much better than he used to be because I just don't see it. Another big guy that they've been building up is The Ascension, Conor O'Brien. And he had a match with Alex Riley that was only slightly more competitive than the Colin Cassidy match with Mason Ryan. O'Brien was part of a tag team called The Ascension until his partner, Kenneth Cameron, got himself arrested. He got released, which left Conor O'Brien in a little bit of limbo there for a while. And I thought maybe they would just plug somebody else into the role. You know, they have this other guy on the NXT roster named Leo Kruger, who's also on the road now doing house shows. I think he was actually also on that Fort Lauderdale house show on Friday night. He's got that look where I could see, you know, him being plugged into that tag team and doing that gimmick. I thought maybe they would do that, but they didn't. And instead, O'Brien is on his own as a single. He's got an entrance very similar to The Undertaker, you know, where the lights go out, this spooky music comes on, the lights are flickering, and actually with that blue hue that they have, it kind of reminds me of Glacier's old entrance in WCW. I don't know if that's good or bad. If ever there was a guy who needed a gimmick name, it's Conor O'Brien. You know, we sometimes ask, where are all the old school names like Axe and Smash and Hawk and Animal, Crush and The Destroyer, The Ultimate Warrior, The Undertaker? This guy really needs a name like that. You know, Conor O'Brien, for a guy who's doing this, I don't think he's supposed to be supernatural, but it's kind of this, I don't know if it's a goth gimmick or what exactly the gimmick is, but doing the character that he's doing, Conor O'Brien sounds far too human. And again, what that name would be, maybe we could have a contest. See who listening to this show can come up with the best gimmick name for Conor O'Brien. You know, call him Bash or something like that. I don't know, but anything would be better than just Conor O'Brien. Just, it doesn't fit the character. The main event saw the Wyatt family combo of Luke Harper and Eric Rowan, reigning NXT Tag Team Champions, beating Corey Graves and Cassius Ohno. Graves and Harper, I wanted to single them out because those two in particular really impressed me in this match. You know, Ohno was good, but Graves stood out more. He was, you know, just quick and crisp and doing some pretty cool moves. I love the deal where Bray Wyatt sits in a rocking chair on the ramp and just watches the match. He interfered towards the finish. Graves took him out with a scary-looking corkscrew plancha to the floor. Meanwhile, in the ring, Harper took out Ohno with a lariat, folded him up, got the pin. Good match. Wyatt family is ready for prime time, and they're going to be a real big deal if WWE plays its cards right. And on the subject of NXT, one other thing I wanted to comment on here is the status of Richie Steamboat. I found myself wondering where he's been, especially now that I'm able to pay more attention and watch NXT more often. And he was one of the big names you heard a lot about. He was a champion back, you know, when they had, it was FCW before it officially became NXT. I think it was the FCW 15 title or whatever it was that he had. But he seemed to be on that path to somewhere, and then he just disappeared. And I saw there was an update this week that he's going to be having back surgery soon. And so I said, boy, let me look up what's been going on here with Richie Steamboat, because he kind of fell off the face of the earth and seemed to be well on his way, and then he got derailed. And Steamboat, of course, is the son of WWE Hall of Famer Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. You may have noticed that he has been MIA, and that has been the case since October, when he suffered that back injury. Now, apparently the injury is serious enough where the surgery is being done by WWE's medical director, Dr. Joseph Maroon, same doctor who operated on Bruno Sammartino's back and who Bruno credits for saving him from basically spending the rest of his life in a wheelchair. The fact that Maroon is also overseeing WWE's wellness program was instrumental in getting Sammartino to agree to be inducted into the Hall of Fame this year and mend fences with the company. That's how much he believes in Dr. Maroon. So if Maroon can get Bruno back in the fold, then this man can work miracles. Hopefully he can do the same for Richie Steamboat. Assuming all goes well with the surgery, it sounds like it's going to be months before he can get back in action. So hopefully things work out well for him. I've only seen a very little of him in action. I've seen some of his matches on YouTube, and you know, he seems like a decent enough worker. I don't think that if he were to come back tomorrow, for example, he'd be one of these guys that ought to be fast-tracked to the main roster. Again, I think Corey Graves, Cassius Ohno, Bray Wyatt was the other one I mentioned from NXT. Those three were the ones to watch out for this year. And there are other guys in NXT who are also really good. Adrian Neville and people like that who weren't even on the show this week. So he'll probably have to spend a fair amount of time yet still in NXT even when he comes back. But the point is, hopefully he is able to come back. Hopefully he'll be okay. You know, it's in his blood. It's literally, I mean, his father's name is Richard Blood. So his name is Blood. I just think that's actually kind of cool. Actually, that would be a hell of a wrestling name. You don't even have to call him Steamboat with the fake name. Just let him use his real last name. That'd be a pretty intimidating name all by itself. Richie Blood. Sounds like a mob name from The Sopranos. Anyway, hopefully everything works out for him and he's back real soon. TNA Impact Wrestling from Thursday night in Duluth, Georgia. Before we get to that, just want to comment here. Slammiversary last week. I did have a chance to watch the Gail Kim, Taryn Terrell last knockout standing match. A lot of people were raving about this match. Wasn't that surprising, really, for me to hear the praise, because I see the knockouts in action on Impact every week, and generally speaking, I enjoy the knockouts matches more than I do the Divas matches, and that may just be because WWE doesn't give the Divas a chance. I can't even really knock the Divas they have, because they probably are a lot better than what we see on Mondays, but the fact is, you see longer knockouts matches. They build more stories. They generally speaking, will pay more attention, only a little bit, but they will pay more attention to the knockouts on Spike. And I watched the match, and it was awesome. It was the first last knockout standing match I've ever seen, which is, again, basically just the last man standing match, only with women. So the same rules. Have to respond to the 10 count, get to your feet in order to win. And Taryn Terrell, for those who don't know, I see a lot of people very surprised by, oh my God, you know, Taryn Terrell went in there and had the best match of her career. And it was. If she's had a better match, I certainly haven't seen it. But I'm not really surprised that she's willing to put her body on the line and do the type of the dives that she was doing. And basically, the end of the match came when they were brawling on the ramp. The ramp in TNA, for those who absolutely refuse to watch TNA, and if you refuse to watch, it's your loss, because they actually have a lot of talented people. I think it's worth certainly giving them a look every now and then, even if you don't watch weekly. But they've got the deal where the ramp is level with the ring, which they used to do back in the day in WCW. So Taryn did a tope through the ropes, but Miss Gail Kim, who was kind of standing in her way, Gail sidestepped her, and Taryn landed on the ramp. So the action spilled out there. Gail Kim was teasing that she was going to pile drive Taryn on the ramp. It didn't work. And Taryn turned it into essentially an RKO. She basically delivered an RKO to Gail Kim off the ramp down onto the floor. And it looked great. The people reacted to it. She got up just at the last minute, won the match. It was a great finish. A lot of people who saw the entire pay-per-view, which I did not, said that it was, up to that point at least, if not maybe even when the show was over, the best match on the entire show. The effort was there. These girls went in there. They kicked each other's ass. They had a great match. It was really fun to watch. Taryn Terrell, she's doing these dives. She did the RKO off the stage. She's a stunt woman. She's a professional stunt woman as well as being a wrestler. So there probably are people who don't know that. I didn't even realize it myself up until about 6 months ago. She had posted a video on her Twitter of her being set on fire. She was wearing the protective suit or whatever it is they put on you. But there she is. She's proud to upload this video of her last night doing this stunt where she's set on fire for like 5 minutes, walking around all set ablaze. She's probably a lot more courageous than I am to do stuff like that. But yeah, she's a professional stunt woman, so she's ready, willing, and able to put her body on the line and take risks, which, you know, hopefully she doesn't take too many risks, but it really paid off here, and it made for a very memorable finish to what I think was a really well-worked match. And, you know, Bully Ray retained his TNA title over Sting in the main event, which means Sting can no longer get any more TNA World Heavyweight Championship matches for the duration of his career. We'll see how long that lasts. AJ Styles lost to Kurt Angle, although it became apparent later on why he lost at the pay-per-view. James Storm and Gunner are your new TNA Tag Team Champions. They won the four-way. Joe Park was supposed to face D-Von for the television title, and he was attacked backstage. And so whenever Joe Park is attacked and he comes up bloody, he morphs into Abyss. He's like Bruce Banner, the Incredible Hulk. So it was Abyss who came out to face D-Von. Abyss beat D-Von, so Abyss is the new TV champion. Chris Sabin did win the X Division title from Kenny King, so they wasted no time in getting the belt on him. And they announced that Kurt Angle is the next inductee into the TNA Hall of Fame this October. So, look, it's hard to argue. Kurt Angle certainly deserves it, but I'm surprised they're doing the Hall of Fame inductions with the, quote, newer guys. I mean, Kurt's been around now for 6 years there, but there are a lot of originals who also deserve some recognition. Jeff Jarrett, AJ Styles, and I was going to say Don West, but I don't think they'll do that. I even mentioned Bob Carter last week, and honestly, I was only half joking when I brought his name up, because without Bob Carter pumping that kind of money into the company, TNA would have been dead a long time ago. But Kurt Angle deserves it. They had a video for him on Impact this week. We'll get into that in a second. Couple of other TNA notes here. Todd Kennelly has been dropped. TNA announcer Todd Kennelly, who made his debut on Impact last October, was dropped from the announce team. He was informed at Slammiversary that they were making the move, and supposedly it's not a budget issue, you know, but instead they just wanted to go in a different direction with the announcers. He was not under contract, which I was not aware of. He was working on a per-appearance deal, and so going forward, as we saw on Thursday, it's back to the two-man booth of Mike Tenay and Taz. Boy, you know, TNA had him on the air as their lead announcer every week, working without a contract. Can you imagine if Vince McMahon just wanted a screw with TNA while the dude was still working there and signed him to a deal and then debuted him on SmackDown 1 week? How bad would that make TNA look? I mean, there are people in certain positions, like your announcers, who, no matter how good or bad you think they may be, should be locked up under some sort of deal. So, yeah, I'm not going to sit here and say Kennelly was the second coming of Jim Ross, because he's not. He still came off as kind of stiff and awkward, but I thought his chemistry with Taz and Tenay was getting better. It was improving each week. You know, Taz would bust his balls a lot early on when he first debuted. It was to the point of feeling uncomfortable, almost like they were picking on the guy. And now when he would do it, it just felt like it was, you know, in jest. You know, Taz was just being a heel. I don't know. You know, Don West used to be absolutely unbearable as an announcer. He would scream and shout, and the problem was Mike Tenay felt the need to compete with Don West, because all West would do was scream, so Mike Tenay started shouting, and it was just, oh God, it was awful. And then over time, Don West, dare I say, got a lot better, to the point where when they replaced him with Taz at the booth, I was bummed, because I thought the dude was pretty good there at the end. And then again, they also made Don West a manager for a brief period. Remember that? He was managing Amazing Red, and Don West was real good. He, you know, it didn't last long, but you saw some flashes of brilliance. There was real potential there for him in that role, and it was the perfect pairing, because as great as Amazing Red is in the ring, he wasn't cutting his own promos or going to be allowed to cut promos or get himself over. I don't even know if he's any good at it. He was a small guy. He had a lot of things working against him, and having a mouthpiece was probably the best thing for him, so naturally they squashed the act and put an end to that. And then inexplicably, that was the end of Don West as a manager. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think that coincided with Bischoff and Hogan's arrival in TNA, so they must not have been fans of him in that role. A poor decision on their part. But anyway, if they knew they were getting rid of Kennelly, they should have at least had Taz kick his ass or something to get some heat, or maybe Kennelly gets Taz so mad and riled up over the course of the pay-per-view that they open Impact this week with exclusive footage from after the show of Kennelly laying face down in the parking lot next to his rental car with a hammer next to his body or something. You know, that way you'd actually have a hammer attack that keeps someone off television for a while. And it gets some heat on Aces and Eights, and it gets some heat on Taz, who is a heel, but you would almost never know it by watching television. You know, he's kind of a heel sometimes, but not all the time. Use it to your advantage, but they didn't do that, so oh well. TNA also released Doug Williams this week. The former X Division champion had been working for them as a trainer down in Ohio Valley Wrestling. Alex Silva, TNA's first gut check winner, may also be gone. His bio was taken down from the TNA website. He had reportedly been out suffering from a really bad concussion. And Jesse Sorensen, the guy who Zema Ion nearly killed, literally, nearly killed with that moonsault in a complete freak accident. They didn't know if Jesse Sorensen would ever walk again. But apparently he is doing better now. His bio was also removed, but I read where they, I believe they've transitioned him into a backstage role in the company. They haven't just gotten rid of him. So that may officially spell the end of his wrestling days. We also found out this week who the big free agent was that Dixie Carter had teased on Twitter that they had signed. Found out that it was Quentin Rampage Jackson of UFC and Pride fame. Got to give Pride some credit here. Jackson is a big-time MMA star. Some might say perhaps his fighting career is on the wane. He's getting older. But he signed a deal to not only compete for Bellator. Bellator, in a lot of ways, is kind of the TNA to UFC. You know, they're the closest thing to a competitor that UFC has. They have television, but they're not even close to being at UFC's level. It's kind of the same thing with TNA and WWE. But the deal is very much like the one that they gave to King Mo. King Mo, who did make an appearance one time on Impact, very forgettable appearance many months ago, where he showed up wearing a robe. And I think he shoved Bobby Roode on his keister, and that was basically the last we saw or heard of King Mo. But King Mo is a big wrestling fan, and so is Quentin Jackson. He grew up a wrestling fan, and they actually had a conference call this week on Wednesday. It was a joint conference call with Bjorn Rebney of Bellator, Dixie Carter of TNA, I think Kevin Kay of Spike, taking calls, and Rampage called the deal a dream come true. He said he always wanted to be a professional wrestler. He talked about the big stars on TNA's roster like Hulk Hogan and Sting and Kurt Angle, and he made some comment. I should have grabbed the audio. He made some comment basically saying, you know, those guys are old, and so I know that I can do this for the rest of my life. It's like, great. He just called TNA's top stars old. I'm sure they're very thrilled with that. But that was the point he was making. As he gets older here, he won't be able to fight forever, but he sees on pro wrestling 60-year-old Hulk Hogan out there every single week and 54-year-old Sting wrestling for the championship, and he probably thinks to himself, hey, if I can get good at this, I can spend the next 20 years of my life doing this. So, hey, more power to him if he can do it. But he talked about growing up in, you know, Memphis, watching Jerry Lawler down there and watching Mid-South Wrestling on Saturday mornings, being a fan of The Undertaker back when he was the Master of Pain early in his career. And Jerry Lawler, Jeff Jarrett, talked about dressing up as the Ultimate Warrior on Halloween. So the dude is a wrestling fan. He's not somebody being brought in, kind of thumbing his nose at it. He's a legit fan. That's cool. He definitely has a lot of charisma. He's got a lot of personality. When he walks out with the chain around his neck, he's got that badass look to him. He was on Raw once, actually, when he was doing promotion for the A-Team movie. He actually has a WWE appearance under his belt. I remember him looking pretty good in that appearance. But he could definitely be a star. I don't know how much he's going to be doing in TNA. Again, they did the deal with King Mo, and King Mo has been completely missing in action. They've gotten nothing out of that King Mo deal. And Quentin Jackson is a much bigger name, a proven commodity, more so than King Mo has ever been. If they can actually get Quentin Jackson on television for any length of time, if they can get him for a match or two, maybe they've got four pay-per-views now, maybe they can get him two pay-per-view matches next year. I mean, that could be huge for the company. But let's talk about Impact here. I liked Impact this week. Nice hot crowd in Georgia. I doubt it's going to be that way next week for the second taping when that airs on TV. But for this week, these people were a lively bunch. Hulk Hogan came out at the beginning of the show to confront Bully Ray. Jeff Hardy came out. They set up a ladder hammer match. for the main event. I don't think there's ever been a ladder match before with a hammer hanging from the ceiling, so they made history here on this show. I have to say, Hulk Hogan looks completely ridiculous with the bandana, the sunglasses, and now the magician glove because of his burned-up hand. Or is it the Michael Jackson glove? Hopefully he doesn't start grabbing his crotch now. But either way, he looks completely ridiculous. I actually think he probably would be better off wearing oven mitts, like I suggested last week. I just think it would be funny. So they set the main event up in that segment. Hernandez beat Chavo in a Bound for Glory series qualifier, so he's in. We saw the arrival of Quentin Jackson backstage. Let it be known that the very first person Quentin Rampage Jackson saw upon arrival at Impact Wrestling, and the first person to greet him, was none other than Pat Kenny, the former Simon Diamond of ECW fame. There is a trivia note right there for you. He also exchanged some pleasantries with Gunner and James Storm and went on his way. D-Von, really pissed about losing the television title, comes out, calls out Abyss. Instead, out comes Joseph Park. They brawled. The Abyss theme music plays, so D-Von, of course, is distracted, as everybody in wrestling is when they hear music. He goes in the ring to wait for Abyss, who never comes out. And D-Von says, well, if you're not going to come out here, then I'm going to go find you, bitch. And he leaves. And we see a shot of Joe Park getting back to his feet outside the ring, and he's bleeding from the mouth. Uh-oh. And so begins his transformation as he goes to find D-Von. Samoa Joe squash Robbie E in a Bound for Glory series qualifier. He beat him with the Muscle Buster. You know, Joe was the hottest thing in this company only a few years ago. I'd like to see them build him back up to that level again. A lot of their focus now seems to be on AJ Styles. AJ's getting the Sting treatment where he's a loner, and they're building him up seemingly for a title match of Bound for Glory with Bully Ray. But I think neglecting Joe is a big mistake. The dude can make them money, so I'd like to see them do more with him. Mickie James had an entertaining exchange with Velvet Sky backstage. Mickie is almost back to playing her old psycho heel character, only not quite as psychotic, but I see flashes of it here. She's awesome at it. She's great. She's much better as a heel than a babyface. She gave Velvet some cockamamie excuse about why she didn't help her last week on Impact when Gail Kim came down. Gail Kim was kicking Velvet's ass, going after her bum knee. So to make it up to Velvet, Mickie handed her an Impact Wrestling lottery ticket. I shit you not, this actually exists. If you live in or happen to be passing through the state of Georgia, you can play the Impact Wrestling Instant Game, which gives you the chance to win up to $25,000. And there is no truth to the rumor that Dixie Carter mailed one of those lottery tickets to Zema Ion with a note attached saying good luck, although it wouldn't surprise me. Anyway, Velvet wanted her rematch for the title. Mickie said, no, I'm already booked, and she left. Mickie is great. They aired the Kurt Angle Hall of Fame video I referenced earlier, which was awesome. Any video like this is going to feel incomplete without all of his WWE stuff. Just like Sting's last year, without all the WCW stuff, it just didn't feel complete. But they worked well with what they had. It was a very good piece. And then we had the Rampage Jackson segment. He came out with the chain around his neck, got a great reaction. That chain, by the way, was given to him by his brother years ago, which is the story behind why he wears it to the cage for all of his fights. And now here in TNA, his brother was a big Junkyard Dog fan, just like he was. Anyway, Jackson came out. Jeremy Borash was in the ring interviewing him. He asked him what it was like to be here, and Jackson said, listen, you know, I know that to be the best, I would have to beat the best, and out came Kurt Angle. He said some stuff before that. The crowd was actually very loud for him, so at first it was kind of hard to hear him, and he was a little shaky the first 10 seconds or so, but then he kind of gained his composure. He was fine. Actually, by the end, I thought that last little bit there that he said about knowing that to be the best, he'd have to beat the best, he did it better than Bo Dallas probably would have, so I don't know what that says about Bo. But then again, you know, I shouldn't say that because Jackson's been fighting for so long, and a big part of promoting your fights and fighting is knowing how to talk. So it's not like he's coming into this cold. The guy knows how to promote a fight. You know, he's not new to this whole thing. Anyway, Kurt Angle came out, and this kind of had a Steve Austin, Mike Tyson vibe to it, although on a much, much, much smaller scale. But the thing I will say about this segment, and this was actually a really, really good segment. The stare down was great. Kurt was great. Kurt basically said, listen, when you are actually ready, implying that he's completely not ready now, which is probably true, you know, I'll be here waiting for you, and I'll prove to you that I am, you know, the best and you're not. That's basically what Kurt said. The one criticism I have of this is it felt way too short. It felt like there was just something missing. And if they had nothing else, I'd rather them, I guess, just end it and not just drag it out and make it worse. But when it was over, I was just like, that's it? I felt like it should have gone another 3 or 4 minutes. That's the only criticism of it I have. It made for great television, and it sets up what could be potentially a huge match for TNA down the road. You're asking a lot of this guy to come in after all these years of fighting, and again, as old as he now is, for him to come in and actually become a really good worker. So I don't know what the future holds for him. I don't know when he'll have that first match. I don't know if he'll be any good. But the potential is there because Jackson is a big name. People know who he is. He looks the part. He's got a lot of charisma. He can do the talking part. The rest is a question mark. But they've set up what, again, could be a huge match for the company down the road. So to me, it's a win-win situation for them. Chris Sabin, Gunner, and James Storm beat Austin Aries, Bobby Roode, and Kenny King in a six-man tag. Storm did far more than you would think, given that he's still hurt, probably shouldn't even be wrestling in the first place. In the end, Sabin pinned King with his cross-legged brainbuster type move that he's now calling Hail Sabin. Mickey James beat Taylor Hendricks, the gut check girl, brought her back. Beat her in a match where the fans did a poor man's impression of that Izod Center crowd the night after WrestleMania that I had the privilege of being part of. They started a loud Cena sucks chant during this match. Then they launched into chants of yes, 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 throwing their arms up in the air. In other words, it was a sign of things to come at Money in the Bank. Unfortunately for TNA, it's the wrong promotion. But Mickey played up a knee injury later in the match, and when Taylor came over to check on her, Mickey, as any good heel would do, lowered the boom and finished her off with a roundhouse kick that actually hit her in the shoulder, not the face, but shit happens. And that was that. Backstage, Devon and Knox were on the hunt for Abyss. They ended up outside the arena, and they filmed this almost like a horror movie sequence. We saw Abyss's silhouette on the wall. He grabs Knox and kind of drags him off to the side somewhere, and then Devon comes back over, and he has no idea what happened to Knox. He's asking for Knox, where are you? And suddenly, somebody off camera slides the television title across the ground on the pavement, slides it over to Devon, and Devon's like, where the hell did this come from? And Knox's dead carcass then gets thrown over at him, and of course it was Abyss. Abyss leaves Devon laying. He says he's taken the television title into the Abyss. How original. Next week on Impact, Sting returns to address his future for the first time since losing to Bully at Slammiversary. He posted a tweet, Sting did, that said, Sunday I was left to fight alone. Message received. Which is good to see, because when Sting lost at the pay-per-view, he lost because Aces and Eights ganged up on him in what was a no-holds-barred match. Not one single person from the TNA locker room came out to help Sting. The same man that all of them were on the stage clapping for and crying over when they announced that Sting was going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Not one person came out to help Sting. So I don't know if it's a situation where so many people kind of chastised them for it, and they said, okay, let's turn this into a storyline, and they told Sting to go ahead and post a tweet, or if this was their plan all along. But whatever the reason, I'm happy they're at least addressing it on television, the fact that Sting was left to fend for himself, and we'll see what that means next week. Also on Impact next week, AJ Styles will meet Kurt Angle in a rematch. This time it'll be a Bound for Glory series qualifier, so I assume the reason AJ lost at the pay-per-view, which he should not have done, is because he's going to win here. Again, I haven't read the tapings. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I'm assuming he's winning this match. And also next week, Bad Influence will battle James Storm and Gunner with the winning team, also qualifying for the Bound for Glory series. Main event was the Hammer Ladder match between Jeff Hardy and Bully Ray, which went to a no contest. So much like the bullshit countout finish to a no DQ match on Raw, we had a what was essentially a no DQ, no countout match here, a ladder match, and there was no winner. So just a bunch of fuck finishes in both promotions this week, which I'm not a fan of. Jeff Hardy and Bully Ray, though, they had a really good match. There was a spot in the match where Bully was sitting in the corner. Jeff had the ladder down on its side and slid the ladder right into Bully's balls. And Bully sold this tremendously. He was in pain literally until the very end of the show. So there was like another 10 minutes left in the show. For the rest of this match, right into the backstage segment that they did, he was still selling his nutsack, as he should. Any male listening to this show right now knows how painful that is. That is legit. He sold it perfectly. He was great in the ring. He's like, Taz, my balls! He's shouting over to Taz, and I think Taz was like, yeah, you should have been wearing a cup. Bully was great here in this match. Jeff Hardy looked like he hurt himself at the end. Basically, what happened is Bully got the hammer. And eventually the hammer ended up in Jeff Hardy's possession. Hardy was swinging the hammer. Bully bailed. He ran to the back. And as Jeff Hardy was coming out of the ring and started running after Bully, he just kind of collapsed almost. He was holding his hip or pointing to his hip. He was pointing to a referee off camera to come help him. The ref had to help him up to his feet. And then they abruptly cut back to whatever their backstage plans were, which was the segment coming up. So I don't know how serious the injury is. I assume it's not all that serious since Jeff has since wrestled on the house shows. But apparently he was hurt, at least that night, and hopefully it's not serious. Show ended with Bully backstage, nursing his balls, wondering where his belt was. He wanted his belt. And as Bully's back is turned, we see Hulk Hogan creeping around a corner with a hammer in his hand, threatening to bash Bully in the back of the head with his hammer, when all of a sudden his daughter, Brooke, comes from out of nowhere. She screams, Dad, no, don't do it. And so now we have this really awkward scene of Hogan standing there with a hammer in his hand. Bully now turns around and sees this. There's Brooke. And that's how they go off the air. So the Hogan family drama continues. They're teasing a Brooke heel turn. They're almost making it too obvious now. Like, she almost can't turn now because it's just too damn obvious. But that's how Impact went off the air. They had Rampage Jackson on this show, but we end with Hulk Hogan and Brooke Hogan. That's TNA right now. That is TNA. And with that, we move on to the mailbag. Got some really good questions to dive into here this week. If you have your own, you can always email me. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the place to send any and all questions. This one comes from Rob, and it's actually a great question. Says, I was recently listening to your WrestleMania podcast, and something caught my attention. You mentioned how people were griping about The Rock being the champion because he was a part-timer and wasn't defending the title regularly on Raw or at house shows. You defended the decision to put the belt on him because it brought mainstream publicity to WWE, and that people who didn't understand that don't know business. Did you inadvertently absolve, to a certain extent, Vince Russo's now infamous decision to crown David Arquette as WCW champion? Never mind Russo's choice for recipient of the title, I'm talking about the rationale for it. Russo claimed that his rationale was for mainstream publicity. According to him, USA Today's little blurb of Arquette as the WCW champion accomplished that goal. Was Russo ahead of his time? Please note that I loathe Vince Russo and all that he stood for. It pains me to think that his ineptitude and stupidity could ever be justified, but I thought about it, and it almost sounds like a double standard to praise WWE and vilify Russo for having the same idea. I see your point, but I'm going to tell you exactly why it's not a double standard, and it's not the same thing. Getting publicity for your brand is never a bad thing. Okay, on this show, I've spoken a lot about how much of an Achilles heel that is for TNA, and how important it is to get their name out there, advertise more, you know, make a splash. And to some extent, they did that this week with Rampage Jackson. The key now with that is how they follow up on it and make money off it. Because I think an angle Rampage match, you know, let's say a Bound for Glory, which may be too soon, but that match, if promoted properly, could do the biggest buy rate that TNA's ever done. I mean, supposedly, they don't release their numbers, but numbers have a way of getting out. Supposedly, their high watermark in terms of pay-per-view buys is 60,000 for a Kurt Angle Samoa Joe match 7 years ago. Rampage was in the main event of some UFC pay-per-views that did over 500,000 buys. And there actually was one show he headlined that did 1 million buys. If TNA could get 1/10 of that, they would be ecstatic. Now, I don't think Rampage would even be close to ready by October, like I said. But you know what? If Bellator was okay with it and he could do enough to get by and get a crash course in Wrestling 101 over the summer, I'd book the match. So publicity is very important, but it has to be the right kind of publicity. There's good publicity, like having The Rock, who is the biggest movie star on the planet right now, coming in to do TVs and work a program with your top stars and putting the title on him. I mean, do you know how many Raw tapings WWE legit sold out in the build-up to WrestleMania when Rock was appearing on those shows? They were selling out every week. It's been years since that happened. And Rock wasn't even on every single show. That was just the period where he was kind of around. He would be on maybe 2 weeks in a row and then would disappear. I think he went away to Panama to film that new show that he's got on TNT, The Hero. He missed like three straight weeks of television. They sold out, I think, every single week. You know, it wasn't a situation where it's just like, oh, hey, it's WrestleMania season. It's WrestleMania season every year. And they haven't had a string of sellouts like that since the boom period. That's money in everyone's pocket, and it gives off the perception that the product is hot, even if it's not true. And then you look at the business that WWE did with WrestleMania each of the past 2 years with Rock in the main event. It's staggering. They broke tons of records. And you know what? Here's another reason I don't see both the same way. I still look at Rock as a wrestler. I know he barely wrestles now. He's been doing movies for years. But he'll always be a wrestler first to me. So that never bothered me because they were never bringing in a big movie star so much as they were bringing back The Rock. If WWE convinced Steve Austin to come back for one more match, or even if they put the title on him, let's say briefly, I wouldn't look at it as a joke, like, oh, look at this, they're bringing in that actor guy, just because he's been making movies since he retired. Which brings me to the opposite of good publicity, which is bad publicity. This was the biggest problem I had with what Russo did. Yes, Arquette was never a wrestler, but if he was a big star who could draw, I might be able to excuse that. It's that he made the company and it made wrestling out to be a laughingstock. People heard David Arquette won the WCW title and they shook their heads, they rolled their eyes, they laughed. Some people cried. Probably killed off what little was left of its fan base by that point. I went back and checked because Arquette only had the title for a few weeks, I think maybe 3 weeks. But the one lone pay-per-view he appeared on after he won the championship, which is where he lost it, was Slamboree. I went back to see how that show fared business-wise because, you know what, maybe I'm wrong and all that publicity actually popped a good number for them that month. Nope. Slamboree did an 0.14 buy rate, one of the lowest of the year. Not the lowest, shockingly enough, but it did dick for business for WCW. Come to think of it, that's really the story of Russo's entire run in WCW. And to be fair, I want to mention this. David Arquette was dead set against having the title put on him. He knew how fans would react to it because the guy's a wrestling fan. He knew exactly how the fans were going to react to him winning the belt, but Russo insisted that he do it, and they convinced him to do it. And after the deed was done, he donated all of the money that they paid him to the families of Owen Hart and Brian Pillman. Okay, Ric Flair talked about this in his book. So at least something positive actually came out of that. You know what? That actually makes him an okay dude in my book. But those are the reasons why it's just two totally different things. You know, Russo, the idea that publicity could be good for the company, that's not a Vince Russo idea. That's common frickin' sense. But they're two totally different things. So no, I'm not willing to give him credit for that because the way he went about doing it, the person he picked for it, was a complete joke. And everybody knew it, apparently, except him. This letter comes from Josu. I have been wanting to ask you this for well over a year. My question was, or is, John Cena more beneficial to WWE as a face rather than as a heel, not counting merchandise? What I mean is that WWE seems to benefit from all the hate that a lot of people have towards Cena, which as a result leads to support for new stars like Punk and Ziggler. Even though they are heels, lots of people do not want to cheer for Cena, so they cheer for the other wrestlers. I believe had Cena turned heel, he would probably get cheered more by smartasses like myself. I can think of lots of reasons why Cena should never turn heel, but the biggest is because I think he can make more stars as a face, for example, The Shield, Ryback, and others. If Cena was heel, the IWC... Oh, I hate that term. Anyway, the internet wrestling fans would probably be so behind him that it would make it hard to make new stars. I see the point that you're trying to make here. I don't disagree that some people may have benefited by the fact that John Cena gets booed a lot and therefore other people get cheered. But the idea that, well, it's better to just keep John Cena as a babyface even though people don't like him, because he's going to make all these new stars. I don't see all these new stars being made by John Cena the babyface. The main one I could think of was CM Punk, and CM Punk was, you know, he already worked his ass off. He kind of made himself. Cena got him over the hump. Cena worked with him. They did that whole storyline where CM Punk would beat John Cena every time they met. You know, John Cena couldn't beat CM Punk until he finally did. I don't want to sit here and say that the reason The Shield is over is because of John Cena. I don't think the two have anything to do with each other. The first time we saw The Shield, I mean, they interfered in a match that John Cena was in, but The Shield feuded with Ryback and Kane and Bryan. I mean, John Cena didn't really have that much interaction with The Shield at that point. The Shield got themselves over. WWE gave them a chance to get themselves over. They booked them perfectly. I don't think John Cena had a whole hell of a lot to do with that. Same thing with CM Punk. He helped him, but Punk got himself over. He sat, you know, cross-legged on the ramp one night and had a microphone put in his hand. He was cutting a promo on John Cena, that's true. But I don't want to give him credit for making CM Punk, or the reason Dolph Ziggler is so popular is because people are tired of John Cena. I think even if the top face in WWE right now was somebody who people did not perceive was being shoved down their throats, if they gave Daniel Bryan the belt and said, here, go, run with it, and Bryan was still going out there getting the big babyface reactions every single week, and people were very happy to have him as their champion, I don't think that means that when somebody talented like Dolph Ziggler comes along, people are going to crap all over him. And I think you may be confusing the issue of being, you know, over or popular, whatever word you want to use, with being, you know, a good guy or a bad guy. You can be a heel, a real vicious, you know, SOB, and still be over as a top guy. As long as WWE gives you the chance to be that top guy and you deliver, you can be that person. That doesn't necessarily mean that if you're a talented guy, without somebody like John Cena, who the people are sick of, you're never going to get a shot. I don't buy into that. I don't believe that to be the case. I want to also read the second part of Josu's email here, because I wanted to address this. He says, another thing I always thought was that it was a good thing CM Punk was not main eventing many pay-per-views while he was the WWE champion, especially as his record grew longer. Had he been in all those main events, some people would have probably turned against him, becoming tired of the guy, thinking he's been fed to us like Cena used to be. Plus, after a few months, it would have felt way too long with him being champion. I think the way they did it worked out fine. Well, you got no debate out of me the way things worked out for Punk. I think things worked out pretty good for him. Made a lot of money. He was champion for 14 months. I disagree with your logic big time. And I'll give you an example here. Stone Cold Steve Austin. When Stone Cold Steve Austin was the top babyface in WWE, so let's go back to 1998 into 99 before he got hurt, he was headlining every pay-per-view. Even the one pay-per-view in 98 where he didn't wrestle. He was a referee for an Undertaker-Kane main event, so technically he was involved, and it was being built around him and whether or not Vince McMahon would fire him, so Austin wins the title of WrestleMania. Well, actually, let's go back even further. He wins the Royal Rumble. He wins the 8-man tag that he was involved in the next month. Wins the title from Shawn Michaels. And from there, he goes on to feud with Foley. He loses the title to Kane. He feuds with Undertaker. I didn't see people getting sick of Stone Cold Steve Austin, did you? I'm sure by the end of his run, you're always going to have a few people who are tired. I mean, look at Hulk Hogan. When Hogan was champion, when he won the title in 84... he held the title for over 4 years. I'm sure there were a decent number of people who either were never Hulk Hogan fans and couldn't stand the guy and hated his guts, or were starting to get a little tired of him by the end of that 4-year run. 4 years is a long-ass time. But you know what? Hogan was still getting big reactions every week. Business was still booming. You didn't see Hulk Hogan coming out getting booed. You did later on, because by 91, 92... I mean, people, you could see it. People were tired. I'll never forget that Royal Rumble match in 92 when Sid dumped him out and the place went nuts. And when they showed footage of it on television a few weeks later, they actually doctored the footage to pipe in boos when Hogan got dumped out, because that was totally not the reaction they were hoping for. So by the end, yeah, people were tired of Hogan, but that first run, he was on fire. Austin's first run, he was on fire. So what if you had a little small minority of people who were getting tired of him? They were the minority. Who gives a shit? So, you know, this lot, oh, it's good that CM Punk wasn't in main events. Nah, it was disrespectful to the guy. You could see that it bothered him, and I don't blame him. John Cena can be in the co-main event. John Cena can switch off every other month. Punk can get himself a main event. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, who cares? Whatever. It's not a big deal. But I wouldn't call it a good thing that you've got the guy wearing your prized possession, your WWE Championship, who can't even buy himself a main event for however many months in a row it was that he was relegated to the undercard. I think it's bullshit. Adrian from Australia writes in, I was listening to episode 259 of the Sound Off, and you said that when Hulk Hogan's name was mentioned at the Madison Square Garden house show you attended, the crowd booed. Hogan is and always probably will be the biggest legend of all time, but yet he gets booed for the years of politics, controversy, and greed. Well, part of it also is all the BS that his family has been involved in ever since that Hogan Knows Best show. This got me thinking of, believe it or not, Michael Jackson, who was the butt of the music world's jokes, much like Hogan is to the wrestling world. However, all of that changed when Jackson died. As you recall, most of that negativity was pushed aside after his death. Do you think the same will happen with Hogan's legacy after he passes? I think the day that happens, the entire wrestling world will finally appreciate what Hogan did for the business and give him the credit he deserves. Will you be one of those people, or should your listeners expect a rehash of episode 75? Well, first, for the record, my rant on episode 75 of the Sound Off was mostly about the media coverage and the circus around Michael Jackson's death, which was just ridiculous. I mean, the man was super talented, don't get me wrong, but my God, I mean, you would think the Pope got struck down by a bolt of lightning or something. It was just completely ridiculous. I wasn't bashing the guy so much as I was bashing the media circus around him. So, just a little bit of a difference there. I think, you know, when that day finally comes, as it will for everyone, I think there's going to be a lot of sad people out there. I've said before, you know, when I grew up as a wrestling fan, my younger days, I was a Hulk Hogan fan. You know, I enjoyed watching Hogan. Hogan was part of some of the biggest matches of my childhood, and he was the biggest star in wrestling, and he'll go down as one of the biggest stars in the history of the business. There's no doubt about that. I don't know, you know, you say, will people finally recognize, you know, what he did for the business or finally give him the credit he deserves? I don't think people aren't giving him credit. I think you just have people who like Hulk Hogan, and you have people who don't like Hulk Hogan. And the people who don't like Hulk Hogan are just going to bash him all the time for no reason at all. They don't even need a reason. You know, they could just point to him rubbing baby oil on his daughter, you know, burning his hand off and posting pictures of it on Twitter and just saying completely ridiculous, completely outlandish things, which is what he's known for. Exaggerating just a little bit, even something like Andre the Giant's weight. Andre the Giant, did you know, was 950 pounds and died 2 days after WrestleMania 3. People can rag on Hogan for a lot of stuff. You know, I'm one of these people where, look, I grew up a Hogan fan. I'm still a fan of Hogan. He does a lot of stupid shit. He says a lot of stupid shit. I'm tired of seeing him as the focal point of TNA programming. You have this promotion that's trying so hard to be successful, that's trying so hard to compete with WWE. They've got a lot, the priorities are out of whack, there's no doubt about that, but they got a lot of talented guys on that roster, whether it's Rude, whether it's Storm, whether it's Aries, AJ, even some of the older vets like Angle. You know, I got no problem with somebody like Kurt Angle being in TNA working with the younger guys. I'm tired of seeing Hulk Hogan as the focal point on TV every week. I'm not going to hide that. You know, I'm well within my rights to sit here and speak my mind and say that I think it's bullshit that Hulk Hogan is the focal point of television every week. It's the Hogan family drama every single week. I think that's bogus. But that doesn't mean that I don't like the guy or that I don't think, you know, that he did a lot for wrestling. I mean, for God's sakes, I wasn't the only one who became a wrestling fan because I liked watching Hulk Hogan on television when I was a kid. There were millions of people out there who probably could say the same thing. That's why whenever he would come back in WWE, he would get those huge nostalgia pops, which is all that it was, because if he stuck around more than a few weeks, he wasn't getting those same kind of pops. But people, it was a nostalgia thing to see Hulk Hogan after all these years come back home, to see the Hulkster who you grew up with. It was a cool thing. I don't minimize the guy's accomplishments. The guy accomplished a lot. Now, how he did that, you know, people may say, well, he was a politician, he held people down, he had Eric Bischoff's ear. That may all be true. He wouldn't be the only wrestler in the world to play politics and protect their spot. I'm not going to condemn him to hell for that. I think when that day comes, I'm going to be real sad. I think a lot of people are going to be real sad because Hogan's going to go down as one of the biggest names in wrestling history, and deservedly so. Made a lot of people a lot of money. helped make Vince McMahon a multimillionaire. Vince wouldn't have been able to do it on his own. Hogan was pretty instrumental, I would say, in the success of that first WrestleMania. I mean, so was Mr. T and all that, but you get my point. So I think it's going to be a really sad day, but I think plenty of people give Hulk Hogan the credit he deserves, and it's okay to bash him when he says and does stupid shit. It's okay. That doesn't mean you're minimizing his accomplishments. It means you're being honest, and there's nothing wrong with being honest. And you can say the same thing about Ric Flair. You know, Ric Flair's made a lot of mistakes. That doesn't mean that when the day finally comes that Ric Flair isn't around anymore, people are going to minimize his accomplishments or poke fun at him. It'll probably be the same situation where you don't hear too many people saying too many bad things about him, because that's just what happens when somebody dies. But people are going to recognize the fact that Ric Flair is probably the greatest wrestler of all time. Tiger Woods. Look at all the affairs, and God, I mean, you lose track of how many women that guy slept with. Good for him. Great. But he made a lot of bad decisions. That doesn't mean he's a bad golfer. Michael Jordan. Maybe the greatest basketball player of all time. He's also maybe one of the biggest gamblers of all time. Does that make him a bad person? Does that mean people are going to minimize his playing abilities and the impact he had on the NBA? Of course not. He's going to go down as the greatest of all time. People know that. But this idea that you have these people out there who are Teflon, you're not supposed to say bad things about them, give me a break. Plenty of smart people have said really bad things about people that they respect, that they like, because you call a spade when somebody does something dumb, you call them out on it. That's what you do. Nothing wrong with that. Ben from Chicago, I don't really have a question, but wanted to follow up on the subject of NXT superstar Jake Carter. You mentioned last week how he's Vader's son. It looks nothing like him, but really looks like the twin of The Miz. It's funny you mentioned that, because Miz played the main guy in the Marine 3 Homefront movie as the character Jake Carter. They should have renamed Vader's son Jacob Carter to avoid further confusion. Does that come from Ben? Bill from Ohio wants to know, what if wrestlers were valued based on everything about their character, including noticing flaws in storylines / continuity and keeping them from happening? What if, for example, the wrestler in TNA known as Doc would actually recognize that celebrating at ringside 1 week after getting hit in the face with a hammer was a continuity problem? Do you think wrestling would be better if the promotions encourage wrestlers to take ownership for how their character is portrayed and actually rewarded them for doing so? I think that'd be a great idea. I think it would be even better if the wrestling promotions themselves recognized these continuity problems and fixed them and avoided them in the first place and didn't put the guy on television 1 week after he got bashed in the face with a hammer. That's what I think would be great. Lastly, Mike from New York wanted to share this fun little story with us. He says, I work in the Disney store in Times Square, and from time to time I see guests in WWE shirts that I make conversation with. So I see a guy covered in tattoos wearing a CM Punk shirt, and after a few minutes of chatting, he explains that he's from overseas and is having trouble dialing numbers in the U.S., and he asks if he could use my phone. I oblige. He calls somebody, and about a minute later thanks me and hands me the phone back. We talk about wrestling for a bit, and he asks me if I know who the Honky Tonk Man is. He tells me that the person he just called was Honky himself. He explained how they met through a family friend years ago, and every time he is in the States, he gives him a ring. This time he invited him to an indie show he was doing that weekend. I couldn't believe a phone call on my phone was made to the greatest intercontinental champion of all time. The story got even funnier when I mentioned emailing you, and he told me he actually loves the Sound Off, and I listened to last Sunday's episode on the flight over. Just wanted to share this with you and give a shout-out to my new overseas friend, Jason, who made my day with this awesome phone call. So that comes from Mike. That's actually a really cool story. And hopefully maybe one of these days I'll see you in the Disney store. I'm just kidding. I wouldn't be caught dead in the Disney store. If you have questions for the Sound Off, you could email them to me again at thesolomonster@gmail.com. I do read everything that comes in. I try to get to as much on the show as possible, so keep sending me your questions. Feed me more. You can follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster is my handle, and don't forget to friend me on Facebook as well, facebook.com/thesolomonster. So that's going to do it for episode 277 this weekend. I want to thank everybody for hanging tough here over 90 minutes of audio this week. I know that will make many of you very happy. We'll be back next weekend with episode 279. Don't forget that 278 is up first. That's going to be the special King of the Ring themed edition of the Sound Off coming up middle of the week, probably later on Wednesday. That is in commemoration of the 20-year anniversary of the King of the Ring 1993 technically Thursday is the anniversary, and that is the genesis of the show. We're going to talk about that pay-per-view and all of the King of the Ring events and pose the question, should the King of the Ring be brought back? It's going to be a fun show, so please check that out and do subscribe to us in iTunes. Until next time, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here midweek and again next weekend for more of the Sound Off right here on Stitcher and SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.